Let's turn the page and consider what Giawa had to say about the covenant. The statement that we considered at the end of our program yesterday came from Bereshith, which is the first book of the Torah. It means in the beginning. It's been given a Greek name, Genesis, by Christians, unfortunately. But this particular statement by Giawa would be just completely out of the blue. I mean, just stunningly out of context, unless you put it into context, unless you make certain that you understand the context that it exists in the Torah. Remember, Abraham had come to Yahweh, and Yahweh came to Abraham, and they had a conversation, and Abraham, Yahweh was continuing to extol on Abraham all the benefits that he would inherit through participating in the covenant's family. And Abraham had a senior moment and said, God, I don't get it. You know, how in the world am I going to get any of these benefits, particularly as you deal with an inheritance? I'm an old guy and I don't have any kids, no family. So inheritance doesn't mean squat to me. And so God took him to heaven and he demonstrated the actual nature of the covenant's inheritance, which is we become like light and all of the profound benefits that are associated with being energy based. And so Abraham said, yeah, well, that's pretty great. I get it. I trust and rely on you. This is going to be wonderful. But you seem to be willing to answer these questions. So I'm going to push my luck here one more time and say, can you provide something for me that gives me absolute assurance that this is going to be mine? And what follows then is extraordinarily profound, as is this specific statement that we're going to consider once again here in Bereshith 15:13. The first thing that God says is, let's have a party. Let's have a festival feast. There's going to be a specific menu on this festival feast. And everything on this specific menu on this festival feast points Abraham's and our attention to the Moed Mikre, to the seven festival feasts, these seven meetings that Yahweh is inviting us to attend each year. They are the means for us to receive all of the benefits of the covenant. It's the means for us to inherit all that God has to give. You know, the first of them, Passover, makes us immortal. The second of them, Matzah, makes us perfect. The third of them adopts us into God's family, firstborn children. The fourth of them provides us with the enrichment and empowerment that Abraham witnessed as God took him to his home in heaven. And so there is that equation. And then there's the components of that feast that we talked about on two different programs that add to our understanding of it. And all of that would have been profoundly important for all of us to appreciate. That's the answer. If you want to know what the assurance is, act upon, answer the invitations to meet with God seven times a year. That's how the covenant's children receive the benefits of the covenant. But there was more to it than that. You see, the next thing that happened was a demonic assault. It's just like Adam and Chawa in the garden were enjoying all the benefits of the covenant. And then Yahweh allowed Hasatan, the adversary, to slither in, Satan, and to provide an alternative so that Adam and Chawa were given a real choice to either continue to embrace their relationship with Yahweh or to reject it, to rely and trust in Yahweh's testimony or to ignore it. In the case of Hasatan, to convolute it, to twist it. Well, the same thing is going to happen now, two generations hence, with Jacob, when he too is going to encounter Hasatan, the adversary, wrestling with him. And so God said, you want to know? All right. Then we're going to make certain that when you are shown the alternative here, that you don't bite. Same thing with Yahusha before he began his ministry, 40 days and 40 nights tempted by Satan. So we have this episode. So we have genuine choice involved here. The option not to trust God is being presented. But Abraham prevailed. He threw everything he had in terms of his consciousness at the assault. So after that, God then has this following statement, which you'd say, this makes no sense when conveyed to Abraham. It doesn't help him at all. But boy, does it ever help us. And let's read it. And then he said, this is Yahweh said, to approach and to be near Abraham, Abram in this particular time, you must know with absolute certainty from yada yada that indeed as a foreigner living and traveling in a temporary, and as being a temporary inhabitant, your offspring, your seed, will exist in a land which is not for them. And they shall serve them. And they shall respond and seek resolution accordingly in 400 years. Now, you know, in the context of that discussion, it doesn't seem even remotely helpful. It certainly is a prediction of what's going to happen in the future, so it's not going to provide any assurance to Abraham. And, you know, this doesn't sound like a real swell deal that, hey, you know, I promised all this wonderful stuff to you and that you're going to inherit. And, oh, by the way, for 400 years, you're going to be slaves, foreigners, foreign land. Going to be bad. But yet, in the context of the whole, of the context of God having a specific seven-step plan to save us from ourselves, perfect answer. Because the historical establishment of the first four of the seven Moed Mikre, and it's the first four that enable all of the benefits of the covenant, they were played out in human history during the Exodus as God saved his people. Once his people responded to him and sought resolution, God intervened and saved his people from Egypt. And we'll consider what Egypt represents in a moment. He saved his people from Egypt so that they might come to live with him and participate in the covenant. It was an essential part of the overall story. And it's specifically how God went about saving his children. And it was through the related events. You've got Passover, unleavened bread, firstborn children, followed by the promise of the Shabbat. All played out in history at that time as God's means of saving his children from human institutions. It was the perfect answer. But more than that, the alternative to God is represented by everything that was Mitzrayim, the crucible of Egypt. It was the living embodiment of political, religious, military, and economic malfeasance. It was all the things that God is trying to get us to leave, to walk away from, that he's saving us from. So it was the perfect answer. Now, as the covenant's children, so long as we are in this world, the realm of human, political, religious institutions, as children of the covenant, we're foreigners. And that contrast is never so vivid as it is between Egypt and the covenant. They are the antithesis of one another. They provide the optimal contrast. Egypt was merciless because it was religious, because it was political, because it was militaristic, because it was manipulative and controlling and indoctrinating and degrading and enslaving. The covenant is merciful because it's caring, enlightening, uplifting, and liberating. God is saying, you know, while you're a child of the covenant, you're going to be a foreigner in man's world. And never are you going to be more of an extreme alien than you are as a child of the covenant in a place like Egypt where religion and politics, militarism and economics were all melded together in one poisonous brew. So in order to tangibly demonstrate Yahweh's plan of salvation and for every aspect of the arrangement to be fulfilled on schedule, Abraham's descendants would be abused in a rather inhospitable clime for a long while. Egypt, after Babylon, was the most politicized and religious place on earth. The politics was the Pharaoh and his family. And he was empowered because of the status he was given by the priests. He was deemed to be the son of the son, and therefore God. And so the politics of Egypt and the religion of Egypt were one and the same. And as such, as a political and religious place, it was awesomely militaristic. And it was savage in terms of its economics, degrading to the common man. Now, while we're on this subject of Egypt, you should be aware that during the past 20 years, archaeologists have found overwhelming evidence attesting to the fulfillment of this particular prophecy and to the witness of the Exodus which followed. Now, I present this in the Matzah Unleavened Bread chapter of the second volume of Yada Yada, available at yadayah.com if you'd like to read it. But there has been all of this written by scholars that say, oh, no, we don't have any evidence of this. Well, in Goshen, they have found the slave quarters. They have found the buildings that were built by the Israelite slaves. They have found evidence of so many young men and women the Israelites maltreated in terms of their skeletons. They found even during the time where Yahweh speaks of the Egyptians killing the male babies, they find all of the archaeological evidence for that. In fact, even now walking across the Sinai, as the Exodus began, we can still see in satellite pictures where that massive number of people were led by God away from Mitzrayim. You can find that when the Exodus is properly timed, that we find all sorts of evidence, even within the Egyptian hieroglyphics, of the weakening of Egypt's power to coincide with this. This is, he is depicting a historical event. And when we move the stones, we find evidence. In this particular statement from Yahweh, I mentioned that Yada Yada was repeated twice. Yada ought to be a familiar word to the listeners to this program. I use Yada as a name. It's not my real name, but I try to be as anonymous as possible. And since the whole purpose of this program is so that you come to know, and particularly know Yahweh, I've chosen Yada as a name. In this particular case, Yada was repeated twice. The Hebrew word Yada is one of several words for to know in Hebrew. Hebrew, like most languages, can represent the concept of knowing in either a cerebral concept or a relational concept. And while there is a crossover between them, Yada embraces most of the relational concepts of knowing, to acknowledge, to recognize, to realize, and it's knowledge that leads to understanding. Now, when a Hebrew word is repeated, it is it's like putting a geometric emphasis on the word. For example, one of the things that rolls off many people's tongues that is familiar with the Torah would be Holy of Holies, which would be the inner sanctum of the temple. But it's there is no holy, and it doesn't say Holy of Holies, even if there was a Hebrew word for holy, and there isn't. It's actually Kodesh Kodesh. Kodesh means set apart. And Kodesh repeated would be most set apart. And so in this way, when you repeat a word in Hebrew, what you're doing is you're emphasizing every aspect of that word, taking it to its natural conclusion. So yada yada means it's extremely important that you know, that you become completely aware of, that you fully comprehend. So when God was conveying this to Abraham for our benefit. It is something he wants us to know. And when you recognize that this was a prophetic statement, and God preceded the prophetic statement with yada yada, I really want you to totally and completely know. Pay attention to this so that you understand what I'm saying, you fully comprehend it. He's really setting the stage for all prophecy. Now, Christians have been beguiled into this notion that no one knows when things are going to happen. That's exactly the opposite of what God is communicating here. He says, I want you to know when things are going to happen. I'm going to give you a very specific timeline, 400 years. You know, a very specific timeline, and I want you to absolutely understand it. That's the same thing with all of his prophecies. As a matter of fact, you can look at yet unfulfilled future prophecies as future history because you can determine exactly when they're going to take place. By yada yada, by combining everything that he has said, by processing it so that you go from knowing to understanding, I know when the tribulation is going to begin. It's the fall of 2026. I know when Yahweh is going to return. Going to be in the day of reconciliations in year 6000 Yah, which is 2033 in our pagan calendars, October 2nd at sundown. I can tell you when the millennial Shabbat, the 1,000-year celebration of camping out with God, is going to commence, which is 5 days later on a Shabbat on October 7th of 2033. These things are knowable because God provided us the information to understand. And he wants us to understand, which is what yada yada means. It has been shared with us for a specific purpose, to provide evidence that we can use to evaluate for certain that Yahweh can be trusted. That's the context that this was shared in. Verifying that his covenant can be relied upon. Precisely how we are to accomplish this will be shared momentarily. Now, moving on. You may have noticed that there was a somewhat awkward transition in this, that we begin with the singular masculine and absolute gear as one making a sojourn, and then it's singular masculine again in Zerah, your seed, your offspring. Masculine singular again with Haya, he will exist. And then that flows from a plural transition associated with this unfavorable land, and it says Lo Hayim, which refers to this land was not for them. So it was either a glaring grammatical mistake, or in the context of yada yada, God is predicting two distinct yet related things, both of which are important for us to understand, one in the singular and the other in the plural. And indeed he is. One of which is symbolically associated with the singular ger as the sojourner, the foreigner, and the other descriptive of the multitudes who were abad, reduced to servitude. There's a prophetic proof statement inherent in both stories. Returning to this particular prophecy, there are lots of clues that help us understand it. Towards the end of the prophecy, after Yahweh says that they're going to be there for 400 years, they're going to be foreigners, and that they're going to exist in a land which is not for them, and they're going to be enslaved there. He uses the Hebrew verb ana, which is they will respond and seek resolution. And ana is a very interesting Hebrew word with a full range of meanings. It was rendered here, answer and respond to a summons, to seek answers and resolution by way of a witness's testimony. But ana has a secondary meaning. That's actually probably its 10th meaning on down. There's probably 24 associated meanings with ana. But the distant meaning is afflict. And it is true that the single sojourner will be afflicted, that he would endure ana, a response to the forced servitude of Abraham's offspring. Ana means to bow down, and it means humiliation, oppression, mistreatment, and becoming downcast. as a word, whose tertiary meaning tells us that it is being preoccupied and sufficiently concerned about it to the point that you're constantly thinking about how it pertains to your prosperity and or duress. Now, the reality here is that Yahweh, manifests in human form, was afflicted on our behalf. For those of us who respond and answer Yahweh's invitations to meet with him, we find that God was willing to afflict himself so we wouldn't be afflicted. And so there is this for the many, one. And so it's the reason why all of this is conveyed in the as a combination of singular and plural, is that many of us have benefited from the act of the One. And that is Yahweh himself choosing to afflict his own soul and the physical body that he accepted for our benefit. And it's for the benefit of those who respond. So here's a word whose dichotomy also tells us a great deal. Now, before we dig in, there's a fourth clue that we have to consider. In order to tangibly demonstrate his seven-step plan of salvation and for every aspect of his plan to be fulfilled on his schedule over the course of 7,000 years, Yahweh's offspring would be oppressed and enslaved for precisely 400 years. The number itself is revealing, forever linking 40, a duration of time equated throughout Yah's testimony as a completion of a period of testing, with centuries themselves, comprised of pairs of yovels. See, the yovel years are 7 times 7 plus 1 year, which pairs of yovels would be 100 years. And it's these yovel years, every 50 years, that debts are forgiven and captives are freed. So it's an extraordinarily important concept related to our salvation, and particularly when placed in the context of Egypt, where the children of Israel were enslaved and they were freed as captives. And that it's not only that they were freed as captives, which is freedom from man's institutions, but we were also forgiven. Our debts were forgiven as part of this process, and that is our sins were forgiven. And so this is a times schedule that every 50 years we humans are asked to act out that which God does for us in the Yovel. Now, these insights, combined with Yahweh's consistent and all-encompassing 6 plus 1 formula, man represented by 6 plus God who is 1, equating to the perfect Shabbat, which is us being together, is emblazoned upon all of his 7 invitations to be called out and meet with God, his 7-step plan of salvation. And it's introduced at it's the very basis of how the covenant's promises are also fulfilled, but it is this path that is set into the historic context of the Exodus, of God freeing us from the religion and politics and the militarism and economic schemes that enslave in Egypt, providing us with the very framework required to properly date every essential step God has taken and will take to save us. So collectively, using all of this information, you and I can yada yada. We can fully comprehend everything we need to know to precisely date the year Adam and Chawa means life giver, Eve is the name of a pagan Mother Earth goddess, were expelled from the Garden of Eden, the Gan Eden, or Great Joy. That's 3968 BCE, year zero, Yah. Prior to their expulsion from the protective enclosure and their subsequent separation from God, these two individuals were immortal, and thus time was immaterial. And therefore, the timeline to redeem humankind, to repair the relationship that had now been severed, to make humankind both mortal or immortal and perfect again, to adopt us back into God's family, it started on the day these things were torn asunder by a pair of rather poor choices. decisions to believe Babel corruption rather than trust and rely upon the word of Yah. Now, the first major event required to reconcile the relationship and to reestablish trust took place precisely 40 Yovel, 2,000 years, that's 40 times 50 years later, in 1968 BCE. That was the year 2000, Yah. It was the time this very same Abraham trusted Yahweh sufficiently that he was willing to follow his instructions, even if it cost him the life of his firstborn child, his only legitimate son. And therefore, the covenant with Yahweh was ratified on Mount Moriah, which means to revere Yah, with God himself providing the sacrificial lamb, just as he would on this very same mountain on Passover, 40 Yovel later, 2,000 years later. And indeed, the three most important days in human history, as well as in Yahweh's plan of salvation, and actually the four, were fulfilled on Passover, unleavened bread, and firstborn children, and then on seven Sabbaths in the year 33 CE, which is year 4000 Yah, exactly 40 Yovel from the time Abraham affirmed the covenant. Also, right on the same place, on Mount Moriah. So while the relationship with the children of Israel was not reconciled on this date, the consequence of sin, which is death, and the penalty of sin, which is separation from God, were resolved. Now, 40 Yovel from 33 CE. I'm sure you can do the math. 40 times 50 is 2,000 years. Pretty easy to add 2,000 years to 33 CE. You get 2033. It's year 6,000, Yah. Yahweh is going to return to Mount Moriah. He's going to do so on Yom Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations. It will begin at sunset, October 2nd, 6:22 p.m. in Yisrael. He's going to do so to reaffirm and renew his covenant with Yisrael and with Yahudah, reconciling his relationship with the children of Israel on the basis of his Torah. It's extraordinarily easy to come to know and understand when and why everything that's important has and will occur. The millennial Shabbat, symbolic of the invitation to be called out and meet with God, of shelters, of camping out with God, will begin 5 days later. Yahweh will camp out with his creation for 1,000 years, bringing us to the year 7,000 Yah, during which time the entire earth will return to the conditioned experience in the Garden of Eden. Each of Yahweh's seven invitations to be called out and meet with him have and will continue to be fulfilled and ordered on the precise day during Yovel years, with the enactment of the first four separated from the fulfillment of the final three by 2,000 years, or by 40 Yovel. Now, the last two, not three, because we do not know what year the Teruah harvest will occur. All we know is that it will precede Yah's fulfillment of Yom Kippurim and Sukkah by at least 7 years, because he tells us that he is not going to allow his children to endure the harshness of the tribulation. Therefore, in 2014, we have 19 years remaining before he returns, and 12 years remaining before the tribulation begins. It is no wonder that the world is devolving so rapidly, that there are so many wars, so many disasters, so much suffering, so much financial malfeasance, all of which is leading to the very predictions that God has made for that horrible time. We have brought it upon ourselves. We have no one to blame but ourselves. Now, a few additional thoughts are in order before we move on. First, creation time is measured in accordance with the theory of relativity, making taking 6 days from the perspective of the only eyewitness at the event, just shy of 15 billion years looking back from our perspective here on Earth. Those who have listened to this program over the last year and a half know that we prove this, going through it in great detail in the opening volume of Yada Yah, so there's no need to repeat that material here. But from the evidence that's provided to us and the microwave background radiation emanating from the Big Bang, a term that Yah himself coined, we know that time was stretched 10 to the 12th power as a result of the relativity, the relative nature of time itself and how it moves more slowly in the presence of great matter, great energy. And so that we can use the 10 to the 12th power to divide these nearly 15 billion years by 10 to the 12th. And we find that indeed an eyewitness to creation would have experienced creation over the course of six 24-hour Earth days. They are one and the same. That's the nature of relativity. We'll be back with our final segment. In our last segment here, I want to continue with what we can know about timing. We have talked about the fact that creation time was based upon relativity, and that we have the means to prove that it was exactly six 24-hour days that transpired to take us up to this point from the perspective of the Creator at creation, which is north of 14 billion years from our perspective. And I know that they're now touting 13.7 as the numbers from the Wilkinson probe, based upon the cosmic microwave radiation that is emanating from the Big Bang. But the time only began once light energy coalesced into matter, and there was a period of time that scientists cannot account for before that occurred, which probably makes up the difference, so that both clocks calibrate perfectly. Next, and second, I would say here, as it relates just to understanding the timeline of human history. The flood, as we know, was a regional event. We examined the region that it occurred. We examined the scientific evidence that we have to date it to Mesopotamia. And it has been explained and proven. It occurred in Mesopotamia all the way up to the Black and Caspian Seas spilling out into the Mediterranean, 2968 BCE. That would have been year 1000 Yah. It wiped out all but eight Homo sapiens, replete with an asama, or a conscience, the faculty used to discriminate between truth and lies, right and wrong, to make moral, just, and rational decisions. The entire chapter of Yada Yah is devoted to the flood, and we have gone over it in this program. Third, Yahweh's first temple was built. The materials for it were at least laid out by Dode and built by his son Solomon in 1968 BCE. 1968 BCE represents year 3000 Yah. It was done on Mount Moriah. The second temple was built on the sound foundation and then destroyed in 70 CE, 37 years after its intended purpose had been made obsolete. Also, fourth, in 1033 CE of the current era, year 5000 Yah, the waters under the Temple Mount became poisonous, announcing to the world that the polluted religion, which had corrupted the words and sacrifice of the Masayah Yahusha, had become adulterous and unfaithful in accordance with the test that is outlined in Bamidbar in the wilderness, Numbers 5, in the midst of the Torah. And the Christian pilgrims who came knowing that it was the 1,000-year anniversary of 33 CE when Yahusha sacrifices enabled the covenant's promises, they died in the thousands as a result of the poisoning. Fifth, Yahusha did not say that no one would ever know the day or the hour he was going to return. During the Olivet Discourse, he used the present tense in a conversation with his disciples. And actually, I should say that the Greek records a discussion translates a discussion that he had with his disciples in Hebrew, where there are actually no tenses. Everything is just true in time. But it's recorded in the Greek in the present tense. It's just to say that none of them would be aware. And so Ida, which is the weakest form of knowing anyway. But it says that none of them would be aware of the timing of the Teruah harvest of saved souls. Further, almost everything in the Olivet Discourse is a citation of Zechariah. And in the Greek just happens to be a rendering of a statement made in Zechariah where the word order is changed. Same concept, same words, just changed in terms of order. In Zechariah, rather than saying that no one would know the timing of his return, it says that he's going to return on the one and only day that is known to him. And so there is one day when he can return and reconcile his relationship with his family. It's the essential day of Yom Kippurim. And so the prophecy depicts it as being the day being Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliations. And the Greek is just a bad translation of that statement. God does not want us to be in the dark. He has provided us with all of the information that we need to ascertain what has happened and what will happen, when it has happened and when it will happen. Because he wants us to use our minds to come to know him and understand what he is offering. We'll continue when Shattering Mist continues tomorrow. May I bless.